The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. So good morning. This is the third talk on questioning as practice, and this was the third in a three-part series. And in the first part, the first talk, I talked about how questioning is a way to kind of engage with our practice. Not only can it be a way to work with our doubt, but it can also be a way to help us investigate what's really happening and to be present with what's really happening. It's kind of having a questioning attitude rather than like, oh yeah, I know this, and kind of tuning out or toning out. And then in the second talk, I talked about how there was a story that are preserved in the Buddhist discourses about a monk who had a lot of doubt and thought that actually maybe the Buddha didn't know so much, and went and asked the Buddha this series of 10 questions, which was a standard set of 10 questions that was going around in ancient India at that time, and which the Buddha refused to answer. But he gave a simile saying that it's just as if somebody had shot a person with an arrow. And then here's the person, we can imagine, bleeding there, dying with this arrow stuck in them. And then the doctor arrives to take the arrow out. And the person says, no, 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 no. Before you take the arrow out, tell me who shot me and from which family, from which clan, where does this person live? Is the arrow made out of this wood or that wood? Was the bowstring made out of this wood? You know, like all these questions that are irrelevant to the fact that this person is bleeding to death, having an arrow in them. So in this way, the Buddha was saying, yes, questioning is good, but be careful, you know, pay attention to which questions you ask, because some of them are irrelevant and won't lead to awakening, won't lead to less suffering. So in this third part, I'm going to introduce another story, Vajragatha, who, unlike Malunkyaputta from last week's story, Vajragatha is not a Buddhist practitioner. He's what they call kind of like a philosopher or a wanderer. In ancient India, this wasn't so uncommon for there to be religious teachers or people who kind of like just dropped out of society and were wandering around looking for spiritual guidance, or maybe themselves were teachers or they were looking for teachers. So Vajragatha is one of these people. And preserved in the Buddhist discourses are lots of conversations that he had with the Buddha. But what's not preserved in the discourses is exactly which order these conversations happen. They're like all distinct, like one's a little sutta, then another conversation's another one. So I've weaved together a few of them in a narrative that makes sense to me and that I think and makes a point that I want to make. But it occurred to me that it would be fun to completely change the order of these conversations and then to see, well, maybe there's something else that gets highlighted if we do that. So I'm just sharing, this is my version of this. I've actually seen a scholar who did them in different order and came up with something different, not too different, but a little bit different. So I just offer this as my way of approaching this and sharing it with you, and we can have a conversation about it, about what you think. So before I start this story of Vajragatha, I'd like to ask you a question. What do you think? Do unicorns have blue eyes or green eyes? Or if you don't like that question, maybe here's a question. Have you stopped beating your husband yet? Right? We could see how both of these questions like come from a place where there are these underlying assumptions, right? The first one, that unicorns have eyes, or that unicorns exist, or that it's important to wonder about them, the color of their eyes, right? And the second one makes this assumption, you know, have you stopped, you know, doing this terrible thing? You know, assumes that you are doing this terrible thing, right? So we could argue that looking at that underlying assumption, the existence of unicorns, or you're doing this terrible thing, is probably more important than actually answering the question, right? We could say that actually asking that question tells about what a view that you have, or maybe a view that I have, right? Because I asked it. You know, so the questions that we ask can point to some underlying beliefs that we have, existence of unicorns, for example. So with that as an introduction, then, I'll talk a little bit about Vajragata. So Vajragata goes to the Buddha and asks if he has any of the view of the of these 10 questions, the exact same 10 questions that Malankyaputta had asked about when he had doubt. I'll see. Here, these are what the questions are as a reminder. Is the world eternal? Is the world not eternal? So this concern about time and, you know, is there an end, which also implies, is there a beginning? Is the world finite? Is the world infinite? This, you know, question about space, like how big is it, or is there a point that's the very, I don't know, just these questions about space, the magnitude of it. Is the life principle and the body the same? Some people translate this, is the soul and the body the same? Is the life principle one thing and the body another thing? This question, like, what is a soul, life principle, source? We could use these kinds of words. Does an enlightened person exist after death? Does an enlightened person not exist after death? Does an enlightened person both exist and not exist after death? Does an enlightened person neither exist nor not exist after death? So, right, this seems like a reasonable question, maybe, that, you know, what happens if people follow this Buddhist path? What happens after death? So these 10 questions were standard questions. We see them in the sacred literature of other traditions at this time. So this was kind of like the how the different religious sects differentiated themselves, is how they answered these questions. So it's reasonable. Vajragata, he's a wanderer, he's a recluse, he's an ascetic. He goes to the Buddha and he asks these 10 questions. And the Buddha says, I don't hold any of those views. And then Vajragata asks him, which I think is a reasonable question, well, what danger do you see that you don't take up any of these views? Like, why not? Why? What's wrong with having any of these views? And the Buddha replies, these speculative views, right? He's calling them speculative because they're about things that we can't know in our direct experience, the magnitude of time, the magnitude of space, and what happens after death. These aren't things that we can know for ourselves. Speculative views are a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a vacillation of views, a fetter of views. Having these views is beset by suffering, by vexation, by despair, and by fever. Having these views does not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, does not lead to peace, does not lead to direct knowledge, does not lead to nibbana. So the Buddha is pointing out that he doesn't hold these views because he could see that holding these views actually is a type of suffering because they deal with abstractions. They aren't dealing with things that we can know for ourselves directly. And not only that, like if you having a view and holding on to a view that you don't know for yourself, but it's an idea, naturally leads to conflicts with others. I have this view, I belong to this group of people, we all have this view, we all have the same this belief. And that's how we identify ourselves. And we are different than those people over there that have a different view about these things that are actually unknowable. So he's pointing to, you know, this isn't how you go to where you can find some peace, where there can be this radical letting go, this cessation of clinging that leads to enlightenment or to nibbana. He's also pointing to something really subtle. It's not obvious on the superficial level. It's something that's really subtle only with, like, I shouldn't say only, but it becomes more clear with meditation practice, that there's like an internal agitation if we are holding on to something that we don't actually know, that we don't have the experience, but it's a belief that we're holding. It's not, I know I've had this experience. I'm trying to think of an exact example. It slipped my mind. I had one. But I can bring to mind the sensation associated with it. Like if you, I've had this experience. Like I just knew something from my own experience. I felt like, okay, this is there's a certain truth around this. And I didn't feel like I had to convince everybody. I didn't feel like I had to fight with people about it. I didn't even necessarily have to talk to everybody about it. It's like, oh, I feel like I know something. So there's a steadiness of that with this, like, I feel like I know something, which is different than this clinging, grasping, I know this, right? Which has a different feeling to, like, oh, I had this experience and this feels real to me. It feels true to me. But holding it lightly, that's a different experience. So the Buddha is also pointing to the different, you know, like this agitation that can happen. Like, I know this, you know, that kind of clinging that can happen. So then Vajragatha then asks the Buddha, which I think is a perfectly reasonable question, after the Buddha saying, well, here's all the problem with speculative views. Well, do you hold any speculative views, right? And the Buddha replies, no, having speculative views is something that I've put away. And then he says, why? He doesn't have speculative views because I have seen form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And I've seen their arising and seen their passing away. So let me unpack that for a little bit. These five things, it's not important that we know exactly what they mean for our purposes here. Form, perception, feeling, mental formations, and consciousness. They're collectively known as the five aggregates. You may have heard that. It's kind of a Buddhist teaching. Essentially what it means, the first one is form. That's the physical form, like the body, you know, things that we can touch. And then the other four, perception, feelings, mental formations, and consciousness, are four different types of interior mental experiences. So we can think of it as the body and the mind. That's how he could think about it. And the Buddha was teasing apart different parts of the mind because he wanted to make it clear everything, every one of our internal experiences. There's no exceptions, every one of our internal experiences. And the Buddha's saying, I've seen them arise and I've seen them pass away. Things in the body arise and pass away. Things in the mind arise and pass away. Then in a different discourse, the Buddha takes this one step further and says that seeing the arising and the passing away of all our experiences, everything, just naturally leads to a certain type of letting go. Because if you can see that everything comes and goes, you may have to see it 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times, but after a while, it stops making sense to hold on to something that you know is going to pass away. It'll come again later, it'll pass away, right? That there's this natural rhythm. The frequency, the periodicity maybe of like how soon they, how quick they arise or pass away may change, but the fact that they arise and pass away doesn't change. And when we see this, it's just natural. It's just natural that we stop clinging, right? We could look at this in the gross level. When leaves, when we start seeing them turn yellow and red and golden on the trees, we don't hold on and insist that the leaves stay on the trees, right? We know it's just part of this process. They go away, and then in the spring, leaves will come again, and then in the fall, they'll turn and they'll go away, right? We know what seems obvious. It's something that we've seen, you know, for however many years we've been alive and aware of these things. We see this happen every season. So, of course, we don't cling to the idea that leaves must be on trees at all times and they must be this particular color at all times. It's the same way. It's the exact same thing. We just see it at more and more subtle levels and more pervasive, like this radical seeing it with everything, with everything. And meditation practice helps us to see it, that more and more subtle things. So the Buddha is saying, I don't have these views because I've actually seen that things arise and pass away. And because they arise and pass away, I'm not clinging. And then the when you're not clinging, kind of the Four Noble Truths lead us to say, that's where you find the freedom from suffering. So it starts with actually having an experience, a direct experience. So the Buddha's like, you know, I don't need to hold views. I don't need to cling to views. I can have ideas. I can have, he didn't say this, this is my interpretation. I can have hypotheses, right? Of course, we have ideas of how the world works and how things are. But what Vajragata is pointing to is this idea, you know, he's like holding on to these particular ideas as the way to help him find freedom. And Vajragata is also asking these questions because we can see that he is, just like I asked that question, do unicorns have blue eyes or do they have green eyes? In order for me to ask that question, it assumes that there are unicorns. In order to Vajragata to be asking this question, is the world infinite or infinite, eternal, not eternal, what happens to a person after they die, is really different ways of asking about what is the self like? Is there, because how would we know if the world was infinite unless there was a self there to know it? So these other questions, these 10 questions, come from a place of assuming that there's this solid, permanent self, soul, maybe you could say. So this Buddha is saying, I have not have those views, A, because they lead to suffering. I like this expression, it's a fetter of views, a wilderness of view, a thicket of views. You know, it feels uncomfortable, right? He's also saying, I don't need to hold on to these views because I have these experiences, things that I know. And as we'll see, he's also going to point out to Vajragata that Vajragata is asking these questions really because Vajragata has this idea about a self and really wants to know about the self. So then the Buddha continues to say to Vajragata, with the destruction, with the fading away, with the cessation, with the giving up, with the relinquishing, these are all different words of saying letting go, of all conceivings, we could think of that as forming opinions or forming notions, of all excogitations. I had to look this word up to say, what is this? It's to think about or to study intensely. With all I-making, with all mine-making, with all this underlying tendency to conceit, letting go of all of those, the Buddha is saying, I have been liberated through not clinging. So the Buddha is pointing towards, you know, holding on to, firstly, you know, I-making, like, I'm the person who has this belief, I'm the person who does this, I'm the person who has this feeling. Mind-making, this is mine, that's not mine, that's yours, and this is mine, you know, kind of like dividing the world up into this way, or this supports me, that doesn't support me. You know, having this view of, we may not have this idea of I-making or mind-making explicitly, but kind of just viewing the world of, you know, this is belongs to me, that belongs, I don't know, to somebody else, I don't even care. This is just mine and that's somebody else's, or something like that. The Buddha is saying, having let go of that and having let go of this trying to figure everything out, this excogitation, he's been liberated through non-clinging. So he's just, here, he's saying, you know, having these views, of course, is associated with clinging. And then he goes on to say to Vajragata, this may be hard for you to understand because you are holding on to views and you accept another teaching. You approve of another teaching. You pursue a different training and you follow a different teacher. This makes perfect sense, right? If we have views and we're holding on to them, we're not really open to different ideas. It's fascinating, actually. There's a lot of research now happening. Like, there's a lot of neuroimaging and looking at the biochemistry and the physiology associated with this phenomenon of having a belief and then having experiences or seeing data coming in all kinds of different forms, either people telling stories or seeing something that completely negates your belief, but you hold on to that belief anyway, right? We see this happening all the time, right? Where people are just, they're so identified with something, and even when they get things that don't fit, that they negate it. So that's what the Buddha is pointing to that too. You can't understand, he's telling the Vajragata, you're perplexed, you're confused about what I'm teaching because you're holding on to a particular idea. And I would say, let's see if we can relax that. We don't have to abandon them. We don't have to abandon all our beliefs. We need beliefs. They help us make sense of the world. The trick here is to not cling to them, is to hold them lightly, is to think about, well, this is my current understanding. This is what makes sense to me. This is what I'm thinking about, as opposed to this is the truth and everything else is wrong, right? There's a big difference there. So of course we have beliefs, maybe beliefs about ourselves, the beliefs about the way the world works. But to find freedom, to find peace, to find well-being, you won't find that by clinging to them, holding on to them, being identified with them, identified so much that you feel threatened, personally threatened, if you, ever that belief or thought gets challenged or threatened. So just say, yeah, this is my current thinking. This is my hypothesis. I think it works this way. I'm not sure, but here's the story I have around it. You know, these are all different ways we can approach it, as opposed to saying, this is the truth and everything else is wrong. So the Buddha said, well, to Vajragata, well, you don't understand because you follow these other teachings, this other teacher. And Vajragata, we see this, it's in another discourse, so this is the one that I'm putting next, then goes to the Buddha and says, well, other teachers actually are answering these 10 questions. And you're not answering these 10 questions, so what gives? That's kind of my interpretation. So Vajragata is saying, you know, you're the aberrant one here. Everybody else has a view. They're saying the world is finite. Some of them are saying the world is infinite. Some of them are saying this is what happens, you know, after a person dies. And the Buddha replies, well, teachers of other sects regard, we come back then to those five aggregates, what the Buddha saw clearly, the kind of the body and the mind. The first aggregate was form, like material form, things that are physical. And the Buddha says, well, those other teachers regard form as self, you know, that they are the physical things. Or do they regard itself as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form? So these four different ways in which we could just think of it as identifying with form, getting tangled up with form and thinking like, okay, this is who I really am. And then the Buddha goes through the other four aggregates. You think perception is self, or self as possessing perception, and he goes through all these lists. If any of you are familiar with the Buddhist discourses, there's a lot of this kind of like repetition, like going through everything. And then the Buddha says, but I don't regard form as self, self as in form. What is this? Self as possessing form, self as in form. And he goes through this whole list. I don't have this. So the Buddha is saying, I'm not identified with the physical or the mental things. I'm holding them lightly. I'm not making up views about things I don't know. Therefore, I'm awakened. I have found liberation. I've been able to let go. And we can see that in another sutta, that Buddha explicitly states that having an answer to these particular questions is to be involved with craving, involved with something conceived, like this, you know, an idea, proliferation of thoughts. You know, all of us have this experience, right? You think about this, oh, I better go, I'm hungry. Well, what's in the refrigerator? Oh, yeah, well, I didn't get that, and I can't believe those things were on sale last week, and I better go, I need a little bit more money, but I don't have more money because I need to go this, and you know how this happens, right? We just get these thought trains. So having these views is involved with craving. What did I say here? Something conceived, proliferation, clinging, and a ground for remorse. Again, right, it doesn't bring freedom to have this really clinging onto these views. Okay, so poor Vajragata, right, he keeps on asking. The Buddha isn't answering him. So then he comes back. Here's yet another discourse. Okay. He calls him Master Gotama. Master, like Mister. And Gotama is the family name. Master Gotama. Is there a self? He just flat out asks. Vajragata asks. And the Buddha remains silent. Doesn't answer. Then Vajragata asks a second question. Master Gotama, is there not a self? Again, the Buddha is silent, doesn't answer the question. And then Vajragata, maybe frustrated, gets up and leaves. So the Buddha was trying to say, it's having these views, in particular a view about a self he's pointing to, but we could think about all kinds of different views, but the views about a self, and clinging to that view, is not the way to liberation. It's not the way to freedom. It's not the way to peace. It's not the way to direct knowledge, knowing things for ourselves. What can we know? We can know that things arise and they pass away, both things in our physical experience and in our mental experience. And when we know that, when we see that repeatedly, it may take 10,000 times till we see it, we just naturally, the clinging starts to let go. And then with meditation practice, we can see more and more ways that we're clinging. And then we can see more and more deeper ways that we can let go. The deeper ways that we can let go, it's a deeper and deeper freedom peace, well-being. So the Buddha didn't answer Vajragata because it's kind of, he felt like Vajragata again still didn't quite get it and was saying, are they unicorns? Are the unicorns have blue eyes or green eyes? And the Buddha was trying to say, I don't want to talk about unicorns. I want to talk about your direct experience. I want to talk about seeing things arise and pass away, not some ideas that you have. So then in subsequent discourses, Vajragata does come back. Has some conversation with the Buddha, decides that the Buddha really is onto something here, and he ordains, practices, and becomes awakened. So he does find his way with this Buddhist practice, but I appreciate him very much, right? These are natural questions, but he doesn't give up, right? He kind of keeps on like asking, well, what about this and what about that? And that maybe he's not getting the answers that he wants or that he was expecting, but he doesn't give up. He's looking for ways, you know, to find way to practice with these things. So if this is a story of kind of the Buddha working with somebody who's asking these questions about the world, I can say actually there are other suttas where the world and the self get, we can think of them as synonyms. So we can imagine these 10 questions are really about what is a self. And then the Buddha not giving a straight answers, instead of giving different teachings. It could be a little bit confusing and maybe even off-putting. So in contrast to the story of Vajragata, I'd like to read a different story. So this story comes from Gil Fronsdal's book. Many of you know Gil Fronsdal is the founder here of the center. And this is his book, A Monastery Within. It's a collection of very, very short little vignettes that happen in a monastery, a mythical monastery. And in this book, the spiritual director, the person who's responsible for everybody's spiritual life and their practice, was an abbess. And if you're not familiar with this word, abbess is the feminine form of the word abbot, who is, you know, the leader of the monastery. So here's the story. A woman came to the monastery determined to ask the abbess how she could discover her true self. She had assumed many identities over her lifetime, most of them identities others had expected her to have. When she presented her concern, the abbess replied, "Since knowing the true self is so important for you, you should ask this question of someone who has fully penetrated this issue. We have a very learned monk here who has read every Buddha scripture and the many commentaries. He has studied with some of the greatest Buddhist teachers of his age. He has spent years meditating. He has deep realizations. Come, I'll introduce you to him." We can imagine that this is kind of like the Buddha, right? The Buddha didn't read the scriptures. He's made the scriptures, right? So the abbess led the woman into the courtyard, where a solitary monk was absorbed in sweeping. "That is him," said the abbess. "When you're interested in the true self, it's important not to be abstract," right? This thing about views or kind of these abstractions, these ideas. "Don't ask what the true self is. Ask him what his true self is." Shyly, but with great hope, the woman walked up to the monk and asked, "What is your true self?" The monk smiled and continued to sweep. Going back to the abbess, the woman said, "He didn't answer my question." "Quite the opposite," replied the abbess. "He gave you the most precise answer he could at this time. When he sweeps, his true self is the sweeping." kind of like a Zen flavor to this, right? But the idea of, instead of giving these abstractions or here's these beliefs or what is your true self? Your true self is the experience of this moment. If you're sweeping, your true self is the sweeping, the activity of sweeping. Right now, I'm the one that's speaking. Part of my, the self is speaking. You're listening. Later, you won't be listening. Maybe you'll be speaking. Right? It's just this idea of getting in touch with our direct experience, what's happening right now, as opposed to getting lost in concepts and ideas and views, which then we have to defend and we get identified with and we get hurt when people don't agree with our views. We feel that we get in conflict with other people because they have different views. I'm not saying we don't need views. I'm not saying we don't need beliefs. We do need them to help us organize and make sense of our world. I'm saying we just hold them lightly. We're not clinging to them. We're not craving them. We're not so identified with them that we can't let them go. When we see somebody else that has something that refutes or somehow makes our view no longer make sense, we're able to say, let me think about that. Instead of say, wow, nope, you're wrong, right? So with that, I think I'd like to open it up for some questions about what I've talked about. If you've been to all three of these talks or just for this talk, do you have questions about what I've said, what I didn't say, about the role of questioning and the role of views in our practice?
Your your illustration of the two unicorns is very interesting. Now, what makes you think that you thought about that? Maybe you already thought about that, and you just don't know it. Maybe you have. There's precognitive activity in the brain that actually makes you creates this illusion that you actually are. Thought about it, but you actually already thought about it. Just a comment.
I think this points to something really interesting. That is that that's maybe another reason not to cling to our views, because maybe I did already think about it, but I didn't. It wasn't in my conscious idea. So there's so much more than we are aware of. There's more information out there, and there's more internal processes, too. So maybe that's even more evidence or reason why we shouldn't cling so tightly, because maybe it's more complicated. Maybe there's more than what we actually are thinking. So thank you, John. I think, was Diana going to go, or then you can? Yes.
It kind of reminded me a couple years ago, I was in San Diego. I have a son-in-law and a daughter, and I have a son. And my son-in-law and my daughter, they're born-again Christians, and their lives are pretty much centered around their faith, and especially what's going to happen to them when they die. And my son is pretty much agnostic, much more in the kind of the direct experience of things. And then there's me, and I'm here. We all grew up together, except my son-in-law. And my son-in-law asked me a couple years ago, you know, Diana, you know, what do you think will happen to you when you die? And actually, I work with a lot of people that are dying, so I know the process very intimately. And I remember saying, I'm doing my best to be here now, which I don't do most of the time. So I said I don't know if it's I have no interest in the hereafter, but you know, it's taking all of my energy and concentration to be now just moments of the day. So anyway, that's what reminded me of this talk. It's like, you know, to me that's overwhelming, and it serves no purpose as I try to at least have moments each day of my life to be here. So anyway, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Diana. That's part of what the teaching was, that sometimes it's irrelevant, right? In terms of, first of all, I want to be respectful. I do know there's a lot of people that are really concerned about this. And for some people, it makes a lot of sense. If there's a lot of suffering in their lives, they want to believe that things will be different later, right? And that brings them some solace. I can understand that. So I do want to be respectful of that. And so there can be sometimes you want to feel like you belong. You want to feel like, okay, I got that all worked out. I don't have to worry about it. But I think what often, if people really closely examine, they still kind of are worrying about it. It doesn't, you know, it's not like you get an answer because you don't actually have a direct experience. There's still that little bit of agitation. I think it's true. And in order, what I see happening for a lot of people, I don't know if it's true for everybody, is that because they have this tiny little bit of doubt, they have to go out there and tell everybody about it as a way to kind of bolster their view. But I think this, what you described, is probably familiar for many of us in the room, that we have family members that have radically different ideas. I know I do, actually. I have a brother who thinks very differently and is concerned for me. I'm not concerned for him in this way. I love him dearly, and that's kind of my practice, is to let him have his way. This is my way. Thank you. Yes, Tanya.
Hi. So I really enjoyed your talk, and I could certainly relate to the piece that holding to a particular view leads to agitation in some way or form. But my question is, how do you put together what you just said with the idea that there is a lot of views within the Buddhist discourse, like Four Noble Truths, it's a view. Noble Eightfold Path, it's a view. Four Brahma Viharas, it's a view. So I'm just curious if you can comment, how do you put those two together?
Yes. So views themselves aren't a problem. We need them. It's how we communicate, all these things. It's this idea, if you cling to views, and like for the example of the Four Noble Truths, the first is there is suffering. And then there's this exposition that's a couple of places in the discourses. So the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering, and suffering is to be understood. So it's saying that there's something to be done about it. It's not just hold this view, but explore it, examine it, see if how it shows up in your life and the life around you. So we need views, but it's if we just are clinging to them and saying everybody else is wrong, then we'll suffer ourselves, and we'll create a lot of suffering because we'll be in conflict with other people. So it's not the views themselves, it's our relationship. Maybe I should say that, our relationship to the views. That's the problem. Oh, that's a legitimate question, I think, right?
I like those stories and the non-answers, and a lot of that just isn't capable of being understood by the mind. And there's, I guess, a little bit of experiences that I've had when there's a direct knowing of some of these things. It's beyond any of those questions, and then the view does, like, the interest in the view disappears. It's like why does that even matter? Like, I can't even say a view about it after that direct experience. I don't even want to articulate one. It feels feels false. It's just kind of just, which is odd. And I admire those people like the Buddha or other writers who can write about it and have it represent somehow the direct experience. But that's not, it just kind of, it just releases itself, I guess.
Yeah, you're pointing, even my saying this, I'm saying you're pointing to something very important, is this idea that this was like a key thing here. The Buddha was trying to make a distinction between direct knowledge and a view. We could also say direct knowledge and our words that we use about it. And we need words, but words point to the direct experience. They're not the same thing. And some words point better than other words, but sometimes what happens is that we have an experience. Then it's just natural human. We're going to use words and language to try to put it in context or interpret it. But then what happens? So now we have words. So then we like interpret these words. You can on audio drama, they can't see what I'm doing with my hands. But then, so now we have the second set of words, right? And then we have this third set of words. And then pretty far, you're lost in concepts and abstract ideas, and you're kind of far from the direct experience. So it's helpful. I can see that there's a kind of frustration. I have this frustration too. Like the language doesn't quite, because it's not the same, but it can point to. And that's what I take solace to, is I'm trying to point to something. And that's why my understanding is why in this, like these discourses, I'm like even this list that the Buddha gives, which I find kind of delightful. What is it? It's that views are a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a fetter of views, like this long list, right? It's because I think he's recognizing that there isn't one single word, but he's just trying to give a feeling. He's trying to give a point towards something, as opposed to saying it's actually this very thing. It's like this family of things. So that's my interpretation of why there's so many like repetitious synonyms in the Buddhas. But thank you for pointing that out. The kind of words are kind of like views, the same thing.
Yeah, and I actually don't feel that frustrated by not having the words myself.
Oh, okay.
I feel actually that it's, I mean, it's different, but no, there's just kind of, it's just like I don't need to, it's curious. And then I listen to other people and it's just like, oh, okay, but I can't quite, in those, whatever those areas are where I have that sense, I can't quite relate, or I don't want to, I just don't have the urge. I guess that's how it is.
Mm, yes.
Which is different than me, who used to have lots of urges to say my piece, and still does in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Yes, Jen, this makes sense to me. Yeah, like when there's a certain knowing, it's, you have a confidence in that, even if it's not a, you don't feel compelled to that. Everybody else has to have that knowing too. Yeah. So it's 11 o'clock. So I think we'll end. If you'd like, you're welcome to come up and ask some questions, or we can talk informally. But I wanted to say thank you. It's been a delight to be here on these Tuesday mornings. And I wish you all a wonderful day.